Thank you very much, Peter. That was just marvelous. I'm so pleased to be with you here this evening in your beautiful town. I grew up in Victoria, a West Coast boy, but I've never visited Portland before, and it is an absolutely gorgeous city from what I've seen of it, with fascinating people. I had really fascinating discussions with people at Portfolio 21 today, conversations with Peter. And it's also an enormous honor to be invited to speak at ILAHI, which really is one of the most renowned literary lecture series in North America. I'm going to speak tonight about this most recent book and about the theme of my current research. The book's title, as you can see, is The Upside of Down: Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization. My work currently focuses on crisis and creativity, on the idea of breakdown and renewal. I've coined a term to try to capture this idea. I call it catagenesis. That's made up of the Greek prefix, the ancient Greek prefix kata, which means down, as in catacomb and cataclysm, and of course genesis, which means birth. And by bringing the two words together, the two roots together in catagenesis, I'm trying to capture this idea of rebirth through breakdown. This is something I think that a lot of us have experienced in some way or other in our lives, especially those of you in the audience. I think there's a good proportion of people out there who have gray hair, like I do. Some of that gray hair probably was caused by some kind of crisis in your life at some point where you had perhaps a financial crisis, a serious illness, the loss of a partner. Perhaps all three of those things together are some combination of serious stresses, challenges that really shattered the order of your life. And you wondered how you could go on. Everything that had been normal was no longer normal. And what you did is you picked yourself up. You return to your core resources and your core values and verities and rebuilt your life anew. And the really key thing here is that for many of us who've been through this process, afterwards we often are better off. We're better adapted to the world. We've learned some hard lessons, but important lessons. And we go on to be happier and more prosperous and healthier afterwards. And that's the idea of catagenesis. Sometimes human beings actually only make the fundamental changes they need to make in a time of crisis or a time of breakdown. Now, this book itself was in some ways a product of a crisis in the 3 years during which I was intensely writing this thing, basically day and night, nonstop, without any holidays. My wife and I produced a book, this book, a dissertation. Sarah wrote her dissertation, and a baby, I mean the two of us. Any one of those would have been enough in a three-year period. But doing all three at the same time was a convergence of stresses, and you'll hear me talk about a convergence of stresses, and at the end of that three-year period, after we completed all these projects, we looked deeply into each other's eyes and said, we're never ever going to try to do anything like this again. Having a child has enormously influenced my way of looking at the world. I started my family somewhat later in my life than normal. Ben is now 2 years old. I'm a writer by profession. I regard that in many respects as my first profession. I cannot express in words what it means to have a child, and I know for every person in this audience who is a parent, you know exactly what I mean. It's inexpressible, the emotional implications. But one thing I think we can say is that having a child gives you a very intimate connection to the future. I look at Ben and I look out 80 years into the future. And across all the divisions in our world, racial divisions, ethnic divisions, class divisions, civilizational divisions, you know, people talk about a clash of civilizations now. The one thing that all people agree on everywhere in the world is that we care about our kids and we want the future to be good for our kids. Now somehow, in a world that's under extreme stress, converging stress, we need to keep that in mind, because a lot of these challenges that we're confronted with, a lot of the problems we face, we're not going to solve unless we start thinking of ourselves as a collectivity on this planet, as a collective we, have a species-wide sense of identity. You can't keep one end of the lifeboat afloat while the other end is sinking. And unfortunately, there are many people sinking on this planet right now, and that will be ultimately bad for all of us and for all our children. I try to think about the future, Ben's future, our children's future, looking out 80, 100 or more years, by telling stories from the past, using stories from the past. And one story that I tell is that of the great San Francisco earthquake, not far from here, really, in 1906, April 18th, 1906, at 5 a.m. in the morning. An earthquake shattered the core of the city. Cast iron water mains were broken. Town gas lines were pulled apart. That was a kind of natural gas or coal gas that was used in those days, and the gas spewed everywhere. Coal-fired stoves fell over, lamps fell over. Electrical utility poles fell down in showers of sparks. The city itself had been largely composed of wood. The buildings were made of wood, and they were shattered, and there were splinters and broken timbers everywhere, and the combination of spark and fuel created fires across the city. And within a few hours, these fires had coalesced into one enormous firestorm. That's the only existing photograph of the entire city of San Francisco on fire. This was an extraordinary disaster, a catastrophe for the people of San Francisco. But it turns out it's also a very good example of what I mean by catagenesis. The city was reborn, and other things happened that are examples of creativity in response to crisis. In fact, one of the world's, I think, most important institutions, one of the modern world's most important institutions, is a direct product of this catastrophe in San Francisco in 1906. Now, I'm not going to tell you what that institution is. You're actually going to have to wait not only for the bike, but to the end of the lecture for the rest of this story. So I hope most of you will stick around. But I want you to keep this story in mind. And it will be, I think the idea of catagenesis, when I conclude with the remainder of the San Francisco story, will be very clear. If I were to summarize the thesis of my work right at the moment and of this book, it's something like this. This is the elevator pitch. If I have to answer the question, so what's your book about between the second and eighth floor of my hotel, I would say, well, I argue that our species, that we collectively are in grave trouble on this planet. But there's hope by virtue of that trouble. The very existence of that trouble, of that threat to our future, is a reason for hope. But whether we can realize that hope and exploit the opportunity it provides will depend largely, I believe, on what we do in the next 10 or 15 years. One of the things that I'm trying to do with my work and in lectures like this is I'm trying to validate a common intuition that many of us share, which is that there are problems developing out there that people don't seem to have a very good handle on. That there seem to be things that are kind of out of control, things that could hurt us that are really quite out of control. Now, I would say that many of the members of our management elites, senior academics and policymakers and politicians, have a vested interest in saying that everything's going to be okay. We know what's going on, we understand the system, we have our hands on the levers, we'll take care of you. Well, of course they're going to say that because their authority, their power, their wealth in many cases arises from us believing that that's the case. But the rest of us look around and look at problems like climate change, an impending energy transition that we don't seem to be prepared for, widening gaps between rich and poor, some of the problems I'll talk about in the next few minutes, and we think, gee, I'm not sure these people really do have their hands on levers, and I'm not really sure they are taking care of us. So one of the things I'm trying to do here this evening and in my work in general is say that if you have the intuition that there are real problems out there in the world that aren't being addressed effectively, you're absolutely right. And the second part of that story is that don't rely on other people to fix them for you, because now it's up to us. Don't look for an expert or a leader or a technocrat who's going to make everything okay. As I'll explain at the end of my presentation this evening, it's now up to us. My argument divides into two portions, a diagnosis portion and a prescription portion. I actually spend most of my time on the diagnosis. I find that lots of people will just say, well, you know, give us the answers. Just tell me what to do. I don't want to hear the rest of it. Just tell me what to do. They want a checklist, you know. We'll go down the list of things and check them off and do this, and everything will be okay. I think we need to spend a bit more time on the diagnosis, because you want to know what the sickness is. You want to know what the problem is before you start proposing solutions. And I think many of the solutions that are being proposed are either ill-advised, at worst, or even at best, not terribly helpful, because there isn't an understanding of the real nature of the challenge we face. So I'll spend most of my time this evening talking about the nature of that challenge, and then I'll come back towards the end to talk about prescriptions and where we can go. My diagnosis has three parts. The first part is a discussion of the tectonic stresses that are affecting our world. I identify five of them, and I identify two things that I call multipliers, and I'll go through each of these. They're mentioned in your handout this evening. I'll talk a little bit about each one of them. These are creating stresses under the surface of our reality that could produce real problems in the future. The second part of my diagnosis is an argument about the relationship between energy and complexity and problem solving. And the third part of my diagnosis, and you can think of this a bit like an onion, as if we're peeling away the onions and we're getting deeper to the more core part of what I'm saying. The third part of my diagnosis at the core relates to the deep causes of these stresses, the driving forces behind them. And that leads me to a discussion and an analysis of the nature of modern-day capitalism, and especially capitalism's growth imperative. I'm going to spend a bit of time this evening on each one of these portions of my diagnosis. Let's begin with the first, the tectonic stresses. I like using an earthquake model to describe what's going on. We all know about the origin of earthquakes, the source of earthquakes. We have tectonic plates that make up the crust of the earth, and some of them press against each other, grind against each other. Over time, pressure builds up, potential energy builds up underneath the surface. And this is the key thing. Everything can look fine on the surface, but there's enormous energy building up underneath. And then for some reason, at some point, it's all released and you have a city-busting earthquake like that one that occurred in San Francisco in 1906. The key idea here is these pressures build up slowly and they're unseen. I identify five of them. And the first is demographic pressure. Now, I'm not so worried about just larger populations on the planet. It's not the overall or sort of total size of the population that's the greatest concern to me. Although I think we would probably be a lot better off in general if we had, say, 3 billion people on the planet than 6.5, which is where we are currently, heading towards 9. But the thing that really concerns me ultimately is differential population growth. I think that's the biggest challenge we face between rich and poor regions, because in some regions of the world you have wealthy regions, you have static or declining populations, and frequently in adjacent areas that are poor you have still rapidly growing populations. One of the places in the world where this differential is most obvious is Europe. If you take the 27 countries currently in the European Union, right at the moment, they have a population of around 480 million people. If you take the 25 countries across North Africa, going all the way out to West Asia, as far as Pakistan. These are the countries that are the largest source of immigrants into Europe. The population is roughly the same. It's around 560 million right at the moment. So you can say the ratio is more or less 1-to-1. In 45 years, by 2050, less than that now, 43 years, the population of Europe will have declined from 470 million to around 400 million people and will be continuing to decline at 2 million people a year as the population ages. The population of the adjacent countries, those 25 countries in Europe's hinterland, will have increased to 1.3 billion people. So the ratio will shift from 1-to-1 to about 1-to-3 within an amazingly short period of time. By the time my son is my age, actually younger than I am, we already can see the results of these population growth differentials. This is a photograph of people moving across the Sahara Desert towards the Mediterranean to migrate towards Europe. Very large streams of migrants are moving towards Europe from Africa and West Asia. Europe is becoming increasingly aggressive and trying to keep them out. When they arrive, in many cases, they have not been integrated, as we see, into the economics and politics of European society. They're often ghettoized, especially in France, in basically suburban slums around city cores, where radicalism develops. And we've seen in the recent French election that immigration issues, and we actually see this across much of Europe, immigration issues are powerfully driving politics in Europe towards the right, and in some cases the extreme right. I would expect, as this population imbalance between Europe and its adjacent countries becomes worse, that the migration pressures would become worse, the instabilities inside Europe in many cases, especially if there were some kind of economic shock, would become worse, and the political consequences will also be very serious. The second tectonic stress is energy scarcity arising from this transition we're going to make in coming decades from what we could call a petroleum age to a post-petroleum age. Currently, conventional oil provides 40% of the world's commercial energy, energy bought and sold in a marketplace, and about 98% of the world's transportation energy. It's literally the stuff the world's economy runs on. But we can say that sometime within the next 20 years, 25 years, conventional oil production in the world will peak and start to decline. Why do we know that this is the case? And I should say that even optimists, even people who generally are opposed to what is called peak oil theory, will agree that if we go out in that time frame to 20 or 25 years, that we're going to see a ceiling to conventional oil production in the world. Why do we know this is the case? Because of what we've seen in oil-producing regions around the world. Some 50 countries in the world, oil-producing countries now, have passed peak oil production. And when we take a look at their experience and graph it, it looks something like this. First of all, you have an oil discovery curve. Oil is discovered in small amounts at first, and then you rise to a peak and decline. And then somewhat later, you exploit that oil, it rises to a peak in oil production and then declines. And both of these curves look like bell curves, roughly. And there's a gap between the peaks of somewhere between 50 and, at the outside, 15 and 40 years. In the United States, peak conventional oil discovery occurred in the 1930s in Texas, actually around 1930 in the big oil field discoveries in Texas. Peak oil production occurred in the United States in 1970. And despite huge investments of technology and capital and resources in the United States, that production has continued to decline in the subsequent decades, now almost 50%. Despite for instance, bringing on Alaska, oil production from Alaska. But we see this in oil-producing regions, basically when about 50% of oil is produced in that region, about 50% of the available oil is actually extracted from the ground, you pass peak oil production and you start a decline. The decline rate is somewhere between 3 and 12% a year. What happens if we take the planet as a whole? We look at the planet in its totality as an oil-producing region. These are data from ExxonMobil. The lighter line shows oil discovery, the darker line oil production or consumption. The left-hand axis is billions of barrels of oil equivalent. Across the bottom, we go from 1900 on the left to 2003, 2004 on the right. You see that oil discovery globally peaked around 1964, with about 60 billion barrels of oil equivalent discovered in that year, and it's declined more or less steadily since then with a couple of reversals, the most significant one being in the 1970s when the North Sea oil fields and Alaska were discovered. The other thing to notice, of course, is what's happening on the right-hand side, that gap between production and discovery. On an annual basis now, we are producing somewhere between 3 to 5 times as much oil as we're discovering. We produce on an annual basis about 30 billion barrels of oil, and we're discovering somewhere between 3 and 10 billion barrels of oil. Now, we can sustain that for a certain period of time because we can use up the capital that we generated earlier, those big oil fields we discovered back in the 40s and 50s and 60s, but we can't do that indefinitely. So you can expect that at some point, that production curve is going to flatten out and start to decline. As I said, even the optimists would suggest this would happen by around 2030 or so. The seriousness of our situation at that point, and it could be much sooner, some people suggest that it's actually happening right now, the seriousness of our situation will depend on how rapidly oil production declines, whether it's 3% or, say, 12%. The gap that opens up will have to be covered by non-conventional oil resources and by other energy sources. There are some real questions about whether we can fill that gap, especially if it widens very fast. I think the general point you can make in terms of tectonic stresses is that energy prices are going to go up, and they may go up very fast at some point in the future. The $3.60 you're currently paying for a gallon of gas may seem like halcyon days at some point in the future. The third tectonic stress that I talk about is environmental degradation in developing countries. This is a photograph of deforestation in Indonesia. This is something that I've studied a lot over the last couple of decades, looking at how various kinds of environmental stress, deforestation, degradation of cropland from overuse, water scarcity from overuse and pollution, how these problems can affect social order, can even lead to violence within societies. And just to summarize very quickly, what we found is that given that in about 50% of the world's population depends directly on local renewable resources like cropland, water, and forests for their day-to-day livelihood. And in many places in the world, you might even say now in a majority of places in the world, those resources are degraded. That increases people's poverty. It causes large-scale migrations from one region to another. It can deepen cleavages between ethnic groups. And it can weaken institutions like governments. For one thing, since it undermines economic activity, it lowers tax revenues. So it actually makes states or governments weaker. All of these stresses within these developing societies make them more brittle, make them less resilient to shock, make them less able to adapt to a rapidly changing world. The fourth tectonic stress is climate change. Now, these are NASA data from last year, January to December 2006, showing temperature anomalies around the world versus a 1951 to 1980 baseline average temperature. Across the bottom, that's Celsius, by the way, from -8 to +8 degrees Celsius. So if you're thinking in Fahrenheit, you can more or less double the numbers. You see that large areas of Canada, including where I live in Ontario, saw warmings in excess of 4 degrees Celsius, or 8 degrees Fahrenheit. Very substantial warming. Now, climate change is really in the news these days. I'm not going to talk about it a lot. Most of you, I'm sure just about everybody here, is quite familiar with the topic. But it's interesting to just dwell for a moment on why it suddenly received so much attention. I think that Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth, certainly had a significant impact. The Nicholas Stern report that came out of the UK at the end of last year that looked at the economic consequences of climate change, the long-run economic consequences, said that they could be as severe as a major world war or a Great Depression, also had a major impact. Another thing, of course, was that we looked out the window of our houses and we saw this. No, you didn't see that map, of course, but we saw temperatures in many cases in North America that were very different at a given time in the year from what we know from our personal experience. We can see warming happening within the short span of our own lifetimes. That really affected people, especially around December and January in eastern North America, where we had some quite bizarrely warm weather. But I think the other thing that's happened that's less noted is a convergence of scientific research over the last 2 years, a lot of which has not been incorporated in the latest reports of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The IPCC reports had a guillotine in the middle of 2005. Any research that was published, even in the leading journals after middle of 2005, was not incorporated into the IPCC reports. And a lot of stuff has come out since then that's very important. And a lot of it relates to what we're seeing in the polls. The concern of scientists principally now is that we're seeing positive feedback loops develop in the poles. That means that we're seeing warming that's producing consequences that can produce more warming. Warming, melting sea ice that opens up ocean water. Ocean water absorbs much more solar radiation. That produces more warming, melts more sea ice. It's those positive feedbacks, and there are a number of them we could talk about, that have scientists particularly concerned. And the evidence of melting in the Arctic is particularly striking. I just use one statistic. The Greenland ice cap, which is the second largest ice cap of, or the second largest ice mass of any in the world, after that in Antarctica, according to two independent scientific studies, is now melting at between 200 and 250 cubic kilometers a year. That's about 200 times the amount of water that the city of Los Angeles consumes on an annual basis. And according to the latest study that was released in November, that rate of melting has doubled in just the last 10 years. I think it's this convergence of evidence from many different streams, maybe a dozen different independent research programs that are producing research about different things, from migrating plants to what's happening in the poles to changing temperatures over the oceans, that has caused many scientists to move from a position, a psychological position, of thinking that this is a problem of grave concern, which is where they were maybe 5 or 10 years ago, to thinking that it's a problem of enormous urgency, that we may have only somewhere between 10 and 15 years to actually start turning around carbon output into the atmosphere and start ramping it down, or we will be at risk of some kind of self-reinforcing climate change because of those feedback loops. Of course, what happens in the poles affects the whole planet. We can't isolate the warming to just the northern part of the planet. Among other things, changes in circulation across the Arctic affect monsoons, for instance, in South Asia. And billions of people, as you know, are dependent upon the monsoons in South Asia and East Asia. The fifth tectonic stress is widening gaps between rich and poor people within societies, and most especially around the world. This is a photograph of a squatter settlement near Manila in the Philippines. Statisticians would say that we have created in the world, if you look at the income distribution for people around the planet, we have created a bimodal income distribution, or a twin humps income distribution. If you want to think of a scale of income from $0 per capita per year to, say, $50,000 out here, average income, we have about 1.2 billion people, that's us, up here, making on average about $32,000 per year. And we have about 4 billion people down here making on average about $1,500 per year. And there are actually not a lot of people in between. For all intents and purposes, we've created a global income structure that has no middle class. And political scientists will tell you that societies without middle classes are vulnerable to political instability and violence, especially when everybody knows what everybody else is doing. And of course, in our wired world where everybody's connected together, those 4 billion people making $1,500 a year know exactly how the rest of us are living. That's a situation that is bound to encourage frustration and anger and resentment among many people. Now, those are the five tectonic stresses, the underlying pressures. I want to talk for a moment about the multipliers. The first is increasing connectivity between us, and the second is what I call a power shift. So let me just say a little bit about both of these. In the last decades, we've seen an amazing increase in the amount of connectivity between us as individuals, between organizations, between groups and corporations, between whole societies, largely because of the IT revolution, the information technology revolution. In many respects, this is a good thing. It allows for synergies of ideas and movements of capital around the planet, allows us to stay in touch with loved ones when they're far away in ways that we never could before. We benefit in many ways from this connectivity, but I'm not one of those people who thinks that in just sort of bald form, the more connectivity, the better. Because some kinds of connectivity can contribute to what specialists call cascading failures within our systems, where you get a situation where it's like a row of dominoes falling over. You knock the first one and all the rest sort of fall over in sequence. We've seen these kinds of cascading failures. In 1997-98, the devaluation of a minor currency, the Thai baht, in the summer of 1997 caused an economic crisis in Southeast Asia that eventually spread around the world. By September 1998, President Clinton was calling it the worst economic crisis the world had seen since the Great Depression. In 2003, SARS spread from southern China around the world in a week, coming to Toronto and shutting down our medical system in southern Ontario. In the same year, in August of 2003, a minor perturbation in the electrical grid in Ohio caused a blackout that left 30 million people without power in northeastern North America. These are tightly coupled, tightly connected, brittle systems. They aren't resilient systems. Now, a lot of us are very familiar with tightly coupled systems. In fact, we participate in creating them, some of us on almost a daily basis, depending on your particular temperament. Next time you're traveling on one of these interstate highways, like the I-90 or the I-5, and you're traveling at high speed, tailgating the person in front of you, and everybody around you is tailgating, that group of cars moving down the road is a tightly coupled system. Let's say, you know, somebody is not really paying attention, they're talking on the cell phone, they're entering a message into their BlackBerry while they're switching lanes. Some of you I know do that. I mean, you all like see all the people looking down right now. And you go out of control, and the next thing you have is something like that, a 60 or a 70 car pileup. Because everybody's so close together, you don't have the space in front of your car to react. You don't have, and this is the crucial concept, slack in the system. You don't have buffering capacity. Slack turns out to be a critical resource because it allows for time, the time for individual elements in a system, individual agents, like in this case, vehicles, people in the vehicles, to respond to a shock, to an unexpected event, and protect themselves. The second multiplier that I think will potentially magnify the power of these tectonic stresses could ultimately make the consequences of these stresses much worse is what I call a power shift. And that's a movement of power down the social hierarchy, all kinds of power, from large organizations and corporations towards subgroups and even to individuals. Now, this power shift is caused in many respects, once again, by the evolution of information technology. And once again, it's often a good thing. This laptop computer I have in front of me has about as much computational power as was available to the entire American Defense Department in the 1960s. And in those days, it would have filled, that computational power would have filled a building about three times the size of this building. Now it's in a box about 4 liters in volume, available to hundreds of millions of people, giving them unimaginable analytical power, knowledge-gathering power, and communicative power. Again, often all for the best. But another kind of power that's migrating down that social hierarchy is the power to kill and destroy. In fact, one thing you can say indubitably about the evolution of technology over the centuries and in recent decades is that as weapons technology has progressed, it's become easier and easier for smaller and smaller groups of people to kill more people in shorter periods of time. The ultimate endpoint of that trajectory will occur when small groups of, say, terrorists get weapons of mass destruction. And I don't think it's an if, it really is a when, because we know that there are lots of people in the world who are trying to get hold of chemical or radiological or biological or nuclear weapons. I think there's actually, though, only one deal breaker in this mix. There's some people who worry a lot about biological weapons. I don't think we're at a point yet where we have to worry a lot about small groups hurting large numbers of people with biological weapons, but we do need to worry about a potential nuclear attack. And the substance that's particularly important there is highly enriched uranium. Now, this is the stuff that was used in the Hiroshima bomb. Most people don't realize that the Hiroshima bomb was never tested. The bomb that was tested in Alamogordo, New Mexico in May 1945 was a plutonium device that was the kind that was used over Nagasaki. The Hiroshima bomb, a gun-type, highly enriched uranium device, was such a simple technology, and the physics was so well understood, it didn't need to be tested. And that's, in a sense, the same today. Relatively unskilled people, if they have access to sufficient HEU, can build a bomb that will destroy the core of any major modern city. New York, London, Paris, Moscow, Washington, Delhi. It takes, conservatively, 100 kilograms of highly enriched uranium to do this. We have about 1,000 tons of highly enriched uranium in relatively insecure storage facilities, largely in the former Soviet Union. The ratio is about 1 to 10,000. That's a figure that doesn't really mean very much to most of us, so I decided to make it clearer for people. The dot at the top is the amount you need to build that bomb, and the rectangle of dots underneath is the amount of highly enriched uranium in the world that's in relatively insecure storage facilities. Now, I call this an extreme Murphy's Law problem. We need a security system for highly enriched uranium that's 99.99% secure indefinitely, as long as this stuff's around. I don't know a single human institution that has that kind of performance record. And that's why, because of the concern about leakage, there are many specialists, such as Graham Allison, the former dean of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, who think that the risk of a nuclear device being used in a major city in the next 10 or 20 years is about 50%. There are people who think he's overestimating it, but everybody who's in this business thinks the risk is real and significant. I consider this two or three of these things going off in major financial centers in the world would do the job, quite possibly. We need to get hold of the stuff. We need to get rid of it. All Western governments should be working much more closely and investing much more money in trying to buy this material or put it in safer storage facilities in the former Soviet Union. So what do we have here? We have these underlying pressures, five tectonic stresses that are dislocating people's lives, potentially, in some cases making them angrier and more frustrated. We have a world that's tightly coupled together that seems to be increasingly vulnerable to cascading failures where a shock in one part can spread across the whole system. And we have a world in which technology of destruction is migrating into the hands of small groups. I look at this combination and I think it's a pretty lethal mixture. And it's particularly dangerous, I think, because of the convergence I talked about before. Research on societal collapse, such as and research on the great revolutions in history, such as the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the more recent Iranian Revolution in 1979, suggests that societies run into grave trouble and are at risk of collapse or major civil turmoil when they are facing multiple stresses simultaneously, when there are converging stresses. And that seems to be exactly the kind of situation we're creating around the world today. And so I think that there's an increased likelihood of some kind of societal crisis. That's the first layer of my diagnosis, the first layer of the onion. Let's go on to talk a little bit about the second layer of the diagnosis. And this is the argument that energy helps us produce complexity, and that helps us solve our problems. Energy, we use high quality energy to create and sustain complex technologies and institutions, and we use complex technologies and institutions to solve our problems. As our problems become harder, we need more complex institutions and technologies, and we need, as a result, more inputs of high quality energy. You might say, well, that's okay. We'll simply get the energy we need. But unfortunately, right at the time when we're facing some very serious problems that need a lot of complex institutions and technologies to be addressed properly, we're going through this energy transition that I talked about before. Now, the best way of thinking about that energy transition is in terms of a concept that specialists call the energy return on investment. This is the amount of energy you get back for every unit of energy you invest to get that energy. In the 1930s in Texas, the oilman who drilled down into the ground got back about 100 barrels of oil for every barrel of oil energy they invested drilling down into the ground and pumping oil out. Now in the United States, oilmen get back around 17 barrels of oil for every barrel of oil they invest. In the tar sands in Alberta, considered by many Americans to be the backstop energy source for the United States when conventional oil gets very scarce and very expensive, the energy return on investment is around 4 to 1. Now, as you slide down that slope from 100 to 1 to 17 to 1 to 4 to 1 towards 1 to 1, you're using a larger proportion of the capital and wealth in your society simply to produce energy, and you've got less left over for everything else you want to do, including dealing with your increasingly complex problems. Now, make no mistake, something like climate change is going to take a lot of energy to address. We're going to have to, over time, build a lot of coastal barriers, perhaps move infrastructure inland, maybe even move populations inland. We're going to have to drill deeper for water. We'll have to pipe water from newly wet areas to newly dry areas. We'll have to desalinize water along coastlines. And we're going to be pumping billions of tons of carbon dioxide underground. All of this is going to take a lot of energy. And it's this contradiction between the increasing complexity and difficulty of our problems and the increasing unavailability of cheap, high-quality energy to allow us to address those problems that I think is one of our core challenges. The third layer of that diagnosis relates to the deep processes that I think are contributing to these stresses. And I start this part of my argument and my analysis by asking a question about what I call a curious fact. And that curious fact is that we are about twice as wealthy on average as we were in the 1950s, not that we were around in the 1950s for the most part, many of us, but on average people today are consuming about twice as much stuff, have twice as much real income as they did in the 1950s, and yet we're no happier. In fact, in the United States, people are twice as wealthy and they're actually a little bit less happy. So why is it that we are obsessed with economic growth? That we are obsessed with becoming wealthier and wealthier, and that the concept of economic growth is sacrosanct within our political and economic discourse? Nobody in our academic and policy elites, no politician, no senior economist, no senior business leader will question the idea that growth is good. Well, that is a curious fact for me, and I spend a lot of time thinking about why we are so committed to growth. And the argument I came up with is fairly straightforward, and it goes something like this. Technological change over time raises labor productivity. That means you can produce the same amount of stuff from a factory with fewer people. And so you lay some of them off. If you don't re-employ those people who are laid off, they will become over time what Karl Marx would have called a revolutionary underclass, or they will contribute to what the great 20th century economist John Maynard Keynes would call a demand failure in the economy. There will be insufficient consumption or demand in the economy to maintain the economy's well-being. In the 1930s, leading up to the Second World War, and it was really in some sense the big lesson of the Second World War, we learned the lesson that demand failures can be, and increasing unemployment can be enormously destabilizing. And the lesson that John Maynard Keynes taught us is that we have to sustain consumption and maintain economic growth. So we maintain economic growth, in a sense, as a social lubricant between rich and poor within our societies. So we can punt the problem of unequal income distribution and gaps between rich and poor into the future. Economic growth allows us to expand the economy and reabsorb labor that's displaced in the economy by technological change in other industries. Well, you might say, so? What's the problem with economic growth? The problem, of course, is that we're starting to apparently run into the limits of what the planet can sustain in terms of throughput of energy and materials in our economies. There has been a view out there for quite some time that, among economists, that we could have our economic growth and our clean environment at the same time. We could protect our environment and grow the economy around the world simultaneously. And the idea was that we could do that by making ourselves ever more efficient in our use of energy and materials. And we have made enormous strides in efficiency since the 1970s, since those first energy shocks. If you look at energy efficiency, we've improved our efficiency about 2% a year in terms of the amount of energy that goes into a dollar of GDP. It's called energy intensity. We've improved energy intensity by about 40%. We use about 40% less energy than we did 30 or 40 years ago for a dollar of GDP. The problem is that on an annual basis, our economic growth has exceeded that 2%. The United States needs economic growth of 3 to 5% a year just to keep unemployment from going up. So overall, the economy has expanded faster than improvements in efficiency. And overall, if you look at something like carbon dioxide output, the load on the environment has increased. America's output of carbon dioxide has increased 20% in the same period of time. Now, I think the evidence is in that although you can improve efficiency a lot, in general, our commitment to economic growth will encourage us to have rates of economic growth that exceed what is feasible over long periods of time in terms of improvements in efficiency. So economic growth over time will tend to expand our impact on the global environment. Now, given that currently we're anticipating that the global economy is going to double every 25 to 30 years in size, so by the time my son is, say, 70, the global economy will have quadrupled in size. We can anticipate that even with very, very significant efficiency improvements, carbon dioxide output in that scenario will have increased perhaps 50% or 100% or more. I think we need to actually revisit the issue of economic growth. Now, I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. There is an accumulation of vested interests and special interests, all of us in many respects, around the idea of economic growth that will keep it a core value for a long time to come. So the underlying pressures that are contributing to those tectonic stresses, the underlying causes, will continue to operate. And we can expect that the risk of some kind of breakdown in the future will, as a result, increase. Now, we can't say exactly when that's going to happen or what it might look like. All I'm talking about at this point are probabilities. But I think that we can say with reasonable certainty that the future is going to be a volatile time marked by crisis, and that in some places in the world we are going to see what specialists would call system discontinuities, and which I simply refer to as breakdown, social, economic, or political breakdown. Now that's the diagnosis portion of my talk. Let's talk for a few minutes about prescriptions, about what we can do. The first thing we have to realize is that breakdown actually isn't the end of the story. It might actually just be the beginning of an interesting story. We need to get beyond a dichotomous view of the future, which suggests that there are only two possible outcomes. One possibility is that we solve these problems and we live happily ever after and everything is ideal. And the other possibility is cataclysmic collapse. That's the Jared Diamond view of the world, or possibility. And that's all we get, guys, just those two possibilities. But I actually think that what these two possibilities mark are ends of a continuum. And there are a lot of possibilities in between. And it's probably going to be the case that whatever happens, the shocks that we experience, will fall somewhere in between those two extremes. If that happens, it may be the case that those shocks can create motivation and opportunity for significant change in our societies. I say this in part because of recent research that's come out from in particular, a body of ecologists. I think some of you have heard Buzz Holling speak here. People working on complex adaptive systems. And this research basically suggests that the most adaptive systems in the world go through a process of growth over time, growth, increasing internal connectivity, sometimes increasing rigidity, then breakdown, reorganization of the components of the system, and regrowth. And breakdown turns out to be a critical element in the adaptation process. Not catastrophic breakdown, what you might call constrained breakdown. This is a concept that was popularized, and we're actually all kind of familiar with it, with the great Austrian economist phrase, the Austrian economist Joseph Schumpeter, when he talked about creative destruction. The idea that the extraordinary adaptability of market economies, the most adaptive institutions human beings have ever created, is derived from creative destruction, a process of internalized breakdown. Companies are founded, they grow, they prosper, eventually they become maladapted to their environment, they go bankrupt, the components of the company, the human capital, the resources, the financial capital are separated and reorganized in new ways in the economy, and overall the economy adapts. Well, we seem to be fairly comfortable with this idea when it comes to our economies, but when it comes to our social and political systems, we think in very different ways. In fact, if somebody were to say, we need a little bit of creative destruction on the political side here, it sounds somewhat unsavory, maybe even a little bit revolutionary. So what do? We adopt a management approach to dealing with our increasingly difficult challenges. Incremental increases in complexity to respond to these problems. Sometimes we'll take a whole new institution and sort of bolt it on the side of our existing institutions. The Kyoto Protocol is a good example. The whole thing becomes, over time, more unwieldy, more complex, less flexible. And one thing we don't do with a management approach is we don't address underlying vested interests, economic and political vested interests that benefit from the status quo. The pressures build up, we don't adapt, and so ultimately when breakdown happens, it's that much worse. Now when breakdown occurs, I think it's worth thinking of this moment in time as what I call a moment of contingency. A moment when a society can be pushed in a positive direction or a negative direction. These are times when people are scared, when they're angry, when they're looking for answers. Exactly the times that the great Irish poet W.B. Yeats was talking about in his famous poem, The Second Coming, when he wrote, "When things fall apart, the worst are full of passionate intensity, and the best lack all conviction." Now, Yeats was doing that famous thing of dividing all the people in the world into two categories, the worst and the best. I would label them extremists and non-extremists. And for the sake of argument, I'm going to assume that everybody here is a non-extremist today. And what Yeats is basically saying is that extremists tend not to have a collective action problem, and non-extremists do. At a time of crisis, when things fall apart, when things the normal order of things isn't working, people are scared, extremists are networked together, they have resources, they know who their enemies are, and they're ready to go. The rest of us are wandering around saying, oh, this is really bad, what are we going to do now? And if there's a lesson, a fundamental idea in my book is that if we really want to prepare for the future, we should think about how we're going to exploit those moments of contingency produced by crisis in the future. We should think now about what we're going to do then, because if we wait till then extremists will likely capture the political and psychological terrain. So, how do we do that? I have a bunch of ideas. I'm going to mention two in the last few minutes of my talk. The first is increasing resilience in our societies and economies and technologies, and the second is preparing for the future. Increasing resilience. This is about making sure that if we're somewhere in the middle of that continuum between an ideal world and catastrophic collapse, and by the way, if you have catastrophic collapse, there's no possibility for recovery, so you don't want to be down there, but if we fall somewhere in the middle, that we don't have such a tightly coupled system that we have cascading failures that lead us all the way down to the bad end of the continuum. This means loosening coupling, increasing slack, increasing buffering capacity, increasing the autonomy and capacity to take care of themselves of individual units within our systems. Now, I could use a lot of examples, but let's just talk about energy. In 2050, we'll look at aerial photographs of, say, a city like Portland in 2007, or a city like Toronto. Actually, Portland may not be a good example because you're quite a ways ahead of other people on this, but let's say a city like Toronto, and we'll look at all of those blank roofs in 2007. And we'll say, that was an enormously wasted resource. Those people could have been producing 20% of their power just from solar panels using existing technology on their roofs. In fact, even in Ontario, which is a cold climate, we can produce 50 to 70% of the heat, space heat energy that we need to heat our buildings, even in a cold climate, simply by pumping it out of the ground underneath the buildings and pumping it into our houses using heat pumps. We don't do that. We don't have solar panels. We don't have ground heat pumps. Instead, we're linked into increasingly unstable electrical grids and a network of natural gas pipelines that extends all the way across the country back to Alberta. And by the way, we've reached peak natural gas production in North America now. We're drilling more and finding less on an annual basis. What we can do is increase the ability of regions, cities, towns, villages, and even individual households to produce at least some of their critical needs for food and water and energy. Not all of their needs. This is not an off-grid suggestion, but you want to loosen the coupling within the grid enough so that the whole system becomes more resilient. The general principle here is increasing the ability of individual units in the system to take care of themselves. The second idea is the idea of planning for the future. In this case, I mean dealing with that collective action problem that non-extremists have. Increasing what political scientists call our social capital, which means our networks of trust and reciprocity among us. We get, by working together, we know whom we can trust, we know who's got particular skills, and through a network of people, we can start to develop scenarios, think about what the future might look like, and what we might do in those various scenarios, and we can think about what we might do in moments of contingency and moments of crisis in the future. How? Well, this is where I get to the point of my current thinking, and I'll just mention a few quick ideas that we can talk about in Q&A in a moment. I'm very interested in the developments in the open source movement. In fact, I think open source innovation may turn out to be one of the most important social innovations of the last century. If somebody had said 10 years ago, we're going to create an encyclopedia. It's going to have 4 million entries. It's going to be based on the internet, and the culture of participation in this project will be voluntary, collaborative, and people, for the most part, will leave their egos at the door. Anyone in the world, anywhere, can change any entry anytime. We're going to run this project for, say, 6 years, and then we're going to bring in the science experts from the scientific journal Nature, and they're going to look at the science entries in this encyclopedia and determine that they're just about as good as the Encyclopedia Britannica's. Now, if somebody had said that 10 years ago, we'd have said, oh, that's impossible, it's nonsense, human beings aren't like that. But we know it exists, it's Wikipedia, and a lot of us use it every day. And I can tell you my students are using it because they will sit in my lectures, and if I make a mistake in my lecture, they're connected with wireless to Wikipedia, and they correct me within 30 seconds. That's distributed intelligence, by the way. This is a really interesting innovation, where you produce a situation where the whole is much smarter than the sum of its parts. Wikipedia is not something that could be created by any one individual. Now, if we look around the world, in a lot of circumstances, collectively, we're acting a lot stupider than we are as any one individual. In fact, if you look at the world as a whole, we have about as much intelligence as a protozoan in a petri dish. We're busy consuming all our resources and pooping up our petri dish and poisoning ourselves. In fact, I would take any single non-mentally handicapped person on the planet and give them the job of running the planet, and they do a better job than we're doing collectively. And yet when you look around the world, you can see places where human beings are able to work together and be a lot smarter than they are as individuals. Right at the moment, the internet is little more than a venue for a cacophony of narcissism. It's full of bullies and badgering and people putting their egos first. And yet, in some places, we see things like Wikipedia, which have a very different culture. Now, I'd like to take the idea of open source and see what can be done creating open architecture, democratic practices and institutions that would involve not thousands or tens of thousands, but tens of millions, even hundreds of millions of people, to try to re-engage people in democratic practice. Now, the architectural issues here are not trivial. We can talk about them in a moment if you wish. But I will say one thing. Just at the time the human species is facing the gravest challenges it's ever faced in its existence, we happen to have in places, serendipitously, we happen to have in place on the planet a rough and ready technological infrastructure for species-wide democracy. Now, I think we should be taking that out for a spin and seeing what we can do with it. Let me just wrap up quickly by returning to the story of San Francisco. I mentioned that this was a good example of catagenesis. And it was in three ways. The most obvious is that the city was rebuilt very quickly, in fact, and the buildings were built in a much better way, so they were much better able to withstand earthquakes. The second way it's an example of catagenesis is much less obvious. The water system was rebuilt. Remember all those cast iron water mains? Well, there was a reason the fire was so bad. There was no water in the water mains for the firefighters. In fact, I understand there was only one functioning fire hydrant in the whole city. So afterwards, when they rebuilt the city, they built two parallel water systems, a civil water system, which is the one all of us are familiar with when we're in San Francisco. You turn on the tap, it supplies you with the water, and a firefighting water system that consists of reservoirs across the countryside, connected with pipes that are designed to better withstand earthquakes. And then there's, as a fail-safe, last-stand technological device, they have 170 cisterns containing up to 100,000 gallons of water located in the center of intersections across the city. They're marked by special hatches. And if an earthquake happens and fires break out and the firefighters can't get any water from the mains, they can come along, pop off a hatch, throw in a submersible pump, and get going fighting fires. Now that's a resilient system. And it was designed and built a century ago. We've forgotten something in the meantime, it seems. The final way that San Francisco is a good example of catagenesis, though, I think ultimately is the most interesting. Remember I said that the earthquake and fire led to the creation of one of the most important institutions of the modern world. Many of the insurance policies held by residents of San Francisco were held with British insurance companies. And there was a huge flow of gold out of England towards San Francisco as the insurance companies made their payments. In fact, so much gold arrived in San Francisco that there wasn't enough vault space to contain it all. In those days, national currencies were tied to the value of gold. It was called the gold standard. And this flow of gold out of England caused a monetary crisis in England. The Bank of England closed the borders to the export of capital to the United States and tripled interest rates in a two-week period. This, in turn, was a direct cause of the 1907 financial crisis in the United States, what is considered to be one of the worst financial crises America had ever faced. Almost overnight, the economy came to a standstill. There were bank runs across the economy, across the country. J.P. Morgan and other major bankers pumped tens of millions of dollars of their own money into the economy to try to stem the crisis and stem the panic, but this time it didn't work. They'd done this kind of thing many times before, or several times before in the 19th century, and it had made a difference, but this time the crisis was too severe. That shock to the elite banking community, to the corporate elites of the country, to the policy elites, and to the American people in general, directly led to the creation in 1913 of the Federal Reserve System, or the Federal Bank, the American Central Bank, that is the backstop against financial panic in the United States and indeed for the whole world. That's an example of crisis producing creativity. Let me just finish by saying, we can try to manage our way out of the problems we're confronting now. And I think management remains very important, and we should do everything we can with those conventional approaches. But I actually don't think ultimately it's going to be enough. And we can expect there will be episodes of breakdown in the future and moments of contingency at times of crisis. And we can turn those crises into opportunities for us to build a better world for our children if we're ready to do so at the time. Thank you very much. Yes.
Hi. Very quick, five in one, pick and choose. Is peak oil a blessing in light of global climate change? Do you have a rural place to which to where to escape? I think the British call it bugger out. Do you have a stash of Canadian maple leaf gold coins buried there? And finally, do you have an opinion on biofuels, especially Eastern Oregon canola oil, and possibly an independent Cascadia which would be the ultimate relocalization.
Okay, stay there. You're going to have to stay there because I'm going to have to go through these. I'll try to answer them all really fast. Okay. The first one, again, was opinion on peak oil and whether that's going to lessen or worsen the climate change problem. Unfortunately, it seems like it's going to worsen it, at least for the time being, because it's going to encourage a shift to coal. And coal releases a lot more carbon dioxide per unit energy. Now, what we have to do here is develop technologies to pump carbon dioxide underground. If we're going to see a shift to coal, we need to develop what are called carbon capture and storage technologies. It's an urgent matter. This should be a Manhattan scale type project in terms of investment. There is evidence. Remember I said that the increment of carbon dioxide increase in the atmosphere every year is starting to increase. It's gone from about 1.8 to 2.1 to 2.5 over the last 5 years. People think that that may well be because oil prices are higher and we're seeing a global shift to coal. So unfortunately, peak oil is going to drive us away from things like oil and ultimately peak gas, away from natural gas. And natural gas, if we want to deal with global warming, is one of the best fuels out there. So we have to work out CCS, carbon capture and storage. What was your second?
A rural place to bugger out to.
Yes.
Northern Ontario.
I live in a rural area. Actually, I don't think there's going to be any particular place. The world's awfully small now. I think the idea that you can sort of escape somewhere and live this out is silly. But I do happen to live in a relatively rural area. Yeah. And we're trying to do what we can to create a sustainable carbon footprint.
Yeah.
Third?
The buried stash of gold coins for
maple leaf. It's a funny question, but you know one of the things we learned in that blackout is that nobody could buy anything because all the ATMs were down, all the debit machines, all the Visa machines were down. They couldn't even buy ice cream cones, and it was a very hot day. Resilience at the personal level means being able to take care of yourself in the case of some kind of infrastructural failure. The standard rule provided by emergency agencies now is you should be able to provide for your family's needs for 3 days. Now, I'm going to ask a question here. How many of you have got provisions laid aside for 3 days for your family? That's not bad, but it's probably not more than 15%. Notice I didn't put my hand up. Next question.
Oh, it was combined... Your opinion on biofuels, especially Eastern Oregon grown canola oil, and that kind of leads into
Cascadia.
Segues into the independent Cascadia or ultimate relocalization.
I wanted you to come back. You can sit down now. I wanted you to come back because I thought these were questions that were good hooks for a bunch of issues. One of the other possible ways out of our energy challenge, and I could talk a lot about energy inevitably, but one of the possible ways out of our energy challenge is to biofuels, but not corn-based ethanol. It has an EROI of about 1-to-1. It's a really stupid way of producing gasoline. I gather this is a hot issue here. Cellulosic ethanol, though, may be a lot better. Now, the problem with cellulosic, there's no free lunch. The problem with cellulosic ethanol is, A, we don't really have the technology worked out. B, even if we do, it looks like the enzymes, which have to be engineered molecularly, are going to be quite expensive. The issue is trying to get the cost down. And C, the front-end processing of the cellulose, whether it's switchgrass or everything, is an extremely chemical-intensive process. So we're going to have huge quantities of waste. The first thing we start with in energy is conservation. The second thing we do is renewables. Between the two of those, we can probably get 40 to 60% of what we need. We're left with a residual of somewhere around 40% that will have to be provided probably by large-scale, centralized, grid-distributed systems. And that is a combination probably ultimately of coal and or nuclear. And if you have to make a choice, we probably need to do coal and try to pump the carbon dioxide underground. And that will be a bridge technology to around 2100 and hopefully something like fusion. But we can go a long way with conservation and renewables, and those should be the first options, not the last. The last thing is about Cascadia. The interesting idea there is the idea of decentralized experimentation within systems. Now, I don't know whether you really have to create an independent unit to do this, but the looser are political arrangements that allow for more decentralized experimentation so that you can have experiments that succeed or fail and the whole system can learn from it, the faster we're going to adapt. Ultimately, that's the way markets work, and we need political systems that work that way too. Let's go to the next question.
Thank you very much for your intriguing presentation. And my question is, in the event that there is a confrontation in the Middle East, we've sent warships into the Gulf, and in the event that something does occur and you have a...
You're talking about Iran, I suppose.
Iran
there's kind of a big confrontation there already. So
Iran, and in the event that something occurs, the petrodollar that's associated with oil, and if Strait of Hormuz is shut down, ultimately my question is, can the current financial system and global markets withstand such a shock? Because there's not enough slack right now where you would have the large bubble that is of their collapse, and it can, with all the debt that people have in their homes and their vehicles, with so many people in such a big predicament at once, will banking systems have people in the streets, or will they just, like the Soviet Union when it collapsed, remain in your homes and start growing food?
You know, the thing is, at the end of the book, I talk about some scenarios. One of the scenarios I develop involves oil prices going to $150 a barrel. I talk about places in the world that are particularly vulnerable to that kind of shock. If you get a spike in oil prices like that, and there are multiple plausible scenarios that could produce that outcome, you're going to find a great deal of impact in poor countries that are highly dependent on imported oil, like Pakistan. Pakistan imports about 75% of its oil and is already extremely unstable, in many respects a very dangerous country. China is importing 50% of its oil. If China doesn't maintain a growth rate of 7 to 10% a year, it will have a great deal of internal political instability. China needs to sell its stuff, especially to the United States, to maintain that growth rate. It does so by lending Americans a lot of money, and Americans have seemed to have an absolutely insatiable capacity to absorb debt, which it keeps the system going, but it's something that many people have recognized can't go on indefinitely. It's impossible to say exactly what would happen, but you pointed to a real concern, that an oil shock would cause a cascading failure within the financial system because there's such an enormous debt overhang, especially in the United States, and because the Chinese financial system is also very vulnerable. If China can't grow, then its political stability is in question. If China's political stability is in question, we've got a real problem in the world. At this point, that's all I can possibly say about that scenario.